Once upon a time, there was a young girl named Sarah, and she was the type of kid who asked a million questions. You know, the type that comes home every day from school. When she was very young, she would always ask, you know, why is the sky blue? Why is the grass green? Why is water wet? And, you know, it was sort of exhausting for her father. He was kind of stuffy. He was uptight. He was an accountant. He worked a desk job all day. His wife, her mother, was a high school teacher, which is a very demanding job. So Sarah's parents, Clarence and Mabel, one day, the three of them were having breakfast together. And at this point, Sarah was about 12 years old. And Sarah had yet another question. And they lived in the foothills of Appalachia. And there was a tall mountain peak in the distance. And they had never climbed it or anything. They had never explored much. And she asked her mom and dad, how tall is that mountain peak? And her dad immediately, Clarence, got out his phone and started to Google it. Well, Mabel put her hand over his phone and stopped him. And he looked at her and he was kind of curious, why would you be? I'm trying to answer one of Sarah's many questions. And she said, you know what? That's an easy way to get the answer, but we don't get out as much, you know, as a family. What if we climbed that mountain peak and got a sense of just how big and how tall that mountain is? And then you could look it up later and find the exact height of it, but I think this is an opportunity for us to take a family excursion into the outdoors.
As they started across their backyard, heading out toward the mountain, they realized that they had to cross a river. And she said, well, where should we cross here? And the father said, well, we have to go upstream or downstream. What do you think? And she said, well, let's go upstream, because I've never been up that way. So as they headed upstream on the side of the river that they had come from, they had to pick a place where they'd be able to cross. And up ahead, they saw rocks and rocks and rocks going across the river where they might be able to get across without getting wet or falling in the river. So as they got up there, they started to cross the river by rock hopping from one to the other. And they got across the river and decided to now head up the mountain, but there was no clear path on where to go. So they decided to follow the stream that was coming out of the mountain because it seemed to have worn away the grass and trees and brush so that they'd be able to get a clear path up. So they went across and they started to rock hop up the stream that had come up the mountain. And as they traveled, they started to see more and more pools of water and little waterfalls and little places where they thought that they, like rock pools of water where they could swim. And she said, this is magic back here. This looks like a movie, like one of the old movies where they go off into the woods and they find things they've never seen. And he said, yes, but this is real. So they headed up, rock hopping and rock hopping. Whenever there was a rock too steep, her father would carry her up to the rock and get her to the next level as she went from pool to pool to pool. As it got a few hours into their hike, they realized they got a little tired and they'd brought snacks with them. So they decided to sit in the middle of a little meadow on the side of the river and have a snack. So they sat down, took out their backpack, got out their drinks, water, and little snacks to eat. And then she said, I'm getting a little tired. Maybe it's nap time. Maybe we could all take a little sleep against this big fallen tree that they had leaned against. So they took a little nap and they woke up a few minutes later and they felt a ladybug. She felt a ladybug on her right arm. And she turned and went, oh my God, Mom, Dad, there's a ladybug on my arm. And then as they saw the first one, they said, oh my God, there's two of them on this. And then all of a sudden there were three of them and four and five, and they started to fill up. And she thought, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. As she turned, the log that they had leaned against to take a nap was covered with ladybugs. You couldn't even see the bark. They had leaned against a ladybug log that was beginning, the bugs were beginning to hatch and come out. And all of a sudden, they saw thousands of ladybugs beginning to fly. And they said, this is magic. So they began to say, we're going to call this Ladybug Canyon from now on. As they got up, they saw all the ladybugs beginning to hatch and watched for a while this magical moment took place. When they got back up on the bouldering and the path to head on up, they started to realize that the waterfalls were getting a little bit stronger and a little bit deeper. So they had to walk on the sides of the waterfalls because they couldn't go in the middle where it was getting deeper and deeper. Then they started to hear the water, and it sounded stronger and stronger as they headed up the path. They realized what they were heading for was a waterfall where the water was falling like 10 feet from up above down into this pool. She said to her dad, can we go swimming? And he said, of course. So they all got in the pool and swam toward the waterfall in this cold, ice-cold pool, but it was so refreshing because it was a hot day. Then, when they got under the waterfall, it started to hit them like a shower. They all looked at each other in the magic of the moment and thought, what's happening? And all this because Dad, we wouldn't let Dad go on Google to find out the height of the mountain. So they had the most amazing swim and then pulled off on the side of the pool and lied down for a while to rest in the grass.
And when they woke up from their second nap, I mean, this was such a leisurely, wonderful day. They had seen ladybugs. They had seen waterfalls. They had gone swimming in this pure, clear water. They had seen some of the most beautiful views of the valley below. And they decided to continue their hike up to the top. And it wasn't much farther. And so they hiked and they hiked and they got to the top. And they all looked around, 360-degree view of the valleys below, the peaks, the other peaks in the distance. And they had a moment as a family. And it was the most connected they had been in a long time. And Clarence realized that Sarah asking all those questions was actually a very wonderful thing. And it pushed him out of his desk job where he had bad posture and was always hunched over a keyboard, and it got him out into the fresh air, and he was thankful for Mabel. He was thankful that she stopped him from looking on his phone because they had this moment that they shared as a family. And from that day on, they made it a tradition in their family to always explore something in the wilderness every weekend. And they continued until Sarah was grown. She had a family of her own. She continued that tradition, and it brought them all closer together, all because Sarah liked to ask a lot of questions. The end.
We were taking a walk out back, and we decided we didn't know which way to go. We were going to head out into the park. All of a sudden, we saw a monarch butterfly, so beautiful, right outside the door, flapping and flapping as if it wasn't going to move, and it just stayed there in the little lavender bush. As we began to walk, it started to fly in front of us, and we were like, oh my gosh, this is so weird. This butterfly's with us. So we decided, well, we'll follow him or her. We weren't sure whether it was a boy or a girl. So the butterfly walks us down the road toward the National Forest, where we just went into the park to follow the butterfly. And the butterfly was like hanging around our heads, going in front, hanging around our heads, as if it was talking to us about our walk and what was going to happen. So as we passed the second river crossing with the butterfly seemed to turn right, which was a famous path that led up into the mountains. So we followed. As we walked along the path into the woods, we got to a point where we saw a little pathway that led down, and we followed it with the butterfly, and there was a pool of water down below, crystal clear. Then it turned around and started to head up back toward the path. We went up along the long path that led to the second pool that it brought us down, a little path that led to the river, and we decided to swim there for a little while the butterfly just hung on a rock. Then we picked up again and started out, and the butterfly again seemed to be leading us toward where it wanted to go. So we went along for about 20 minutes and found a dry riverbed at the bottom on the left, and the butterfly started to head into the woods. So we thought, oh my gosh, is the butterfly leaving? or telling us where to go. So we decided, well, so far we've been intelligently led, we'll follow it. So we go up this dry riverbed, jumping from rock to rock to rock, till all of a sudden we reach a part where it's all hidden, and the butterfly goes up and over the bush. So we decided we'd follow. We push the reeds of the bushes to the side, and all of a sudden we see emerald green, a private, hidden, secret pool, looked like it was 20 feet deep, with a waterfall dropping into it from up above. And then another waterfall, and another waterfall, all hidden inside the park. A place we would never have known to look had not this butterfly taken us for the ride. The butterfly was jumping up in the air, back and forth, above this pool, as if it was saying, "We got here, we got here, we got here." We all decided to swim again, diving into the emerald water from up above and below. We ended up spending an hour there swimming with the butterfly. And on our way back toward home, butterfly stayed with us. And now we had three butterflies, and then four butterflies. It was like a train of butterflies that was picking up to head us back home. Each of us, the four of us, each having a butterfly around our heads, getting ready to take us on the walk back home.
And on the walk back home, we met an elderly woman who told us her name was Sarah. And she said she had been coming to this mountain since she was a child. She explained to us that she was a child that asked a lot of questions, and that's what led her to the mountain. And she said, you should come back tomorrow and see the animal sanctuary I've set up at the base of the mountain, because it seems like you enjoyed your day, and I'm sort of the unofficial queen of this mountain because I've taken my family and now my grandchildren. My parents have since long gone, but it was a tradition that they started, and we're trying to preserve this mountain for people who can appreciate the natural beauty, and I'd love for you to be a guest tomorrow at my animal sanctuary. And she said to us, she said, do you like pigs? And we said, well, of course, who doesn't love pigs? I mean, they're practically sentient beings. And she said, well, do you like antelope? We have some antelope as well. And we said, of course, we love antelope. And she said, I've got snakes, I've got turtles, there's a pond. It's a beautiful place. So tomorrow, meet me at the base of the mountain and I will show you. So the next day, we got up very excited to see Sarah's animal sanctuary. We had a good breakfast, had some coffee, and the coffee in the region was the best. We had been traveling sort of all around the country and on a summer vacation, and we had tasted coffee all over the United States, and this coffee had some of the freshest roasts we'd ever tasted. So we had a good cup of coffee, and we set off to meet Sarah at the base of the mountain. And we walked and walked and walked. And, you know, the mountain was wide, and we weren't sure whether she was on the north side of the mountain, the east side of the mountain, the west side, or the south, but we just kept walking. And as we walked, we saw a butterfly. And we knew from yesterday's experience that that butterfly was going to lead us to wherever we needed to go. And so we followed. And sure enough, the butterfly, who we named Bob, because we felt like we knew this butterfly. We felt close to this butterfly. We had had a day with butterflies and a wonderful day on the mountain, and we felt like this butterfly needed a name. So Bob the butterfly led us directly to Sarah's animal sanctuary, and it was the most incredible thing you've ever seen. It wasn't like a zoo where all the animals are sad and depressed and rolling around in their own waste. It was open air and the animals looked healthy. The coat of hair on the antelope just glistened in the summer light. The pigs were dirty because pigs are dirty, but they were super happy. There were some cows, and there was the funniest little goat, and that goat's name was Clarence and Sarah approached, and she saw that we were taken by this goat. He just had such an interesting disposition. He carried himself. He was almost like an old soul. Like he was, it's like he knew something that we didn't know, that he was in on some joke that we didn't understand. And he just sort of had a glint in his eye. And she saw that we were taken by Clarence. And so she approached us and she explained that she had named the goat after her late father, the accountant, who led her to the mountain for the first time. So she showed them around the sanctuary, and they were amazed when they discovered,
unlike a zoo and any other place they'd ever been where animals were contained, they realized there were no fences anywhere. There were no ropes, there were no chains, there were no places where they were held. All of these animals gathered there by free will. They wanted to stay there. They weren't brought there or kept there. And they said, oh my God, this is not a sanctuary. This is a community of animals that are free to go anytime, but they want to stay here. So as they walked around and they saw the elephants, and then they saw the lions, and then they saw the bears, they realized none of them were being aggressive with each other. None of them were acting like they would hurt anyone else. They were all so happy resting and sleeping and napping and eating. And it looked like they were talking like a community of animals. None of them seemed to be upset with each other. And they didn't seem to be aggressive with the people that were in our group. They all just seemed to be like they were in a state of bliss, happy, like a little Shangri-La that they wanted to live in. So we kept walking along, speaking and seeing and petting the different animals in each different group, and realized this was a place of joy. This was a place of love. This was a place of taking care of each other like nothing they'd ever seen before. Then at some point, when they got ready to go, they wanted to say goodbye to Sarah. So she said, oh, it's so great to see you. You can come anytime that you want, and please feel free. We feel like we have karma with you, so please feel free to keep coming over and over whenever you want. Please just come by. So the family started to leave, but the dad hadn't gotten to say goodbye to Sarah. He said, wait, I'll be right back. And he ran behind the barn, where when he went to see Sarah, he saw her standing there looking the other direction. And then all of a sudden, she snapped her fingers without knowing he was there. She became the butterfly. She had led them the entire way. She was a butterfly as well as a Sarah, and she could take people wherever she wanted, and she wanted to introduce the family to this place. So she became the butterfly and never told us that she was actually both. So father, in awe and amazement, ran back to the family and said, you're not going to believe what I just saw. Sarah is the butterfly that took us for the ride yesterday. And the family, in their awe, said, makes sense. I thought she was so special.
The end. Once upon a time, there was a young man fresh out of college, and he was having trouble getting a job fresh out of college, as many people do. And he really needed some extra money because he had this old car that he had been fixing up. It was the love of his life at the time. He has since met people and he no longer has a car as the love of his life. He's since married. The story has a happy ending. But at that time, he was just a young single guy who loved his car more than anything. And the problem was the speakers in his car were the old factory speakers, and they had this buzzing sound every time. He liked to listen to outlaw country music really loud, and he especially loved fiddle music, and specifically he loved the electric fiddle. And if your speakers are not up to snuff in your ride, that electric fiddle, which is a bit of an acquired taste, I'll admit, that electric fiddle is very hard on the ears. It's a piercing screeching, and his friends wouldn't want to ride with him. You know, he would offer to pick up his buddies to take them places, and they were like, Billy, his name was Billy. They said, "Billy, we can't ride with you because your speakers are awful and you play this awful electric fiddle music. And you're literally the only person we know who enjoys it, and it's awful for all of us." They said, "Billy, you need to get a job so you can buy some new speakers." He said, "I know, I've been looking, but the job market is not great, you know? The economy is not fantastic, there's inflation. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to earn money." And they said, "Well, Billy, you have a college degree." He said, "Well, yeah, I know, but it's a sculpture major, and that's not gonna really pay the bills right now. You know, I followed my heart in school, and I threw a lot of clay, and I really enjoyed it, but I'm really having trouble monetizing this skill. I mean, you know, I've got pottery all over the house, but no one really wants to buy it. I don't think I'm very good at it. Like, what should I do?" Well, so one day, he picked up his friend, Frank, and Frank got in the car, and sure enough, Billy turned on the stereo, played this awful electric fiddle music, and Frank finally said, "Billy, I've got an idea for a job for you."
Billy was curious. He asked his friend, whose name is Frank, "Where are we going?" Frank said, "Turn right." Billy turned his car right. They both got out of the car and looked up at the famous Golden Arches. Yep, Billy was about to work at Mickey D's. Billy walked in with Frank at his side and asked to see the manager. The young woman behind the counter said, "Is there a problem, sir?" Billy said, "No, I just would like to talk to the manager." She said, "Was there a problem with your order?" Billy said, "Oh, I didn't order a thing. I just needed a second to talk to the manager." And she said, "Well, would you like to order something?" Billy raised his voice and said, "I need to talk to the manager about a job." Everyone turned and looked at Billy, who felt bad that it appeared that he just yelled at this young woman. He meekly lowered his head and said, "I'll also have 3 McGriddles, please." The woman behind the counter said, "We actually don't serve breakfast after 11 o'clock. Billy was perturbed. "I thought McDonald's served breakfast 24 hours a day." "No, they stopped doing that a couple years ago." Now Billy was upset. "But why?" "Oh, I just think it was something that corporate did. I think that they weren't making enough of a profit. I think they found, well, I should say their research found that people were not eating breakfast items much past noon." Billy told her, "I constantly eat breakfast items past noon. I had a full McDonald's breakfast for dinner yesterday." The woman looked at him and said, "From where? We don't serve breakfasts after 11. Billy told her, "I know, but it's an old one I had from 2 days ago that I reheated for dinner." The woman nodded and understood. "Let me get the manager for you." Billy, slightly annoyed, rolled his eyes as his friend was wiping up some soda he had spilled on the floor. Billy said, "Were you trying to drink soda with your hands?" His friend nodded, embarrassed. "Is there someone in here looking for a job?" a voice called out. Billy turned to see a very, very tall man walking towards him with the clipboard. But he wasn't, like, tall in the sense that he was taller than average. No, this man was 8 feet tall if he was 1 foot tall. He walked up to Billy and shook his hand. "Hello, I'm Mr. Gabriel. I'm the general manager of this McDonald's store. I understand you're looking for employment." Billy nodded. "Yes, I would love to talk to you if you'll have me." "Of course." Mr. Gabriel motioned towards a table and chair. "Would you mind if I took the chair and you could take the bench? The bench is difficult for me." "Oh, is it because of your height?" Billy asked. "No, I have sensitive buttocks that make it hard to sit on that kind of substance." Billy nodded and sat opposite Mr. Gabriel. Mr. Gabriel asked Billy, "Why do you want to be part of the McDonald's family?" And Billy told him, "Well, I'm really looking to up my speaker game for my car. I love electric fiddle, and I would love to be able to afford speakers that can equalize it properly. So when I'm listening to the song they play at the end of Revenge of the Nerds, I'm not bleeding out of my ears. Mr. Gabriel nodded. Ah, yes, those pesky nerds. That was a great song. He was surprised that he knew the song. He liked this guy. How long have you worked here? Billy asked. 32 years, said Mr. Gabriel. Wow, said Billy. That's amazing. Billy stared at Mr. Gabriel. Mr. Gabriel knew what was coming next. You're wondering about my height, aren't you? Yes, I am, sir, said Billy. How tall are you? Mr. Gabriel looked at him and said, I am 8'1". Technically the tallest man in North America. Billy was shocked. What do you want from McDonald's? Says Mr. Gabriel. Well, very simple, said Billy. I want two things. I want you to bring back breakfast permanently, and I want a job. Mr. Gabriel took off his sunglasses and chuckled. Well, let me say, I think I can make one of those things happen. He put his hand out. Billy stared at it and shook his hand. Billy asked, you're bringing back breakfasts? Mr. Gabriel said, no, I'm giving you a job.
And so Billy was, he was bummed about the breakfast thing, but in the short term, he needed a job. So he happily accepted the offer. So the next day, he started his shift. And it was an early shift. He had set his alarm. His alarm was set to an electric fiddle radio station, because that's how he liked to wake up. So the sweet, sweet sounds of electric fiddle pumped through his little boombox clock radio thing that he had. It was vintage. He liked the vintage way of waking up. And he showered. I mean, it wasn't even light out yet. It was pre-dawn, but he wanted to make a good first impression and get there early because he had strong opinions on McDonald's breakfast. And so it made sense that Mr. Gabriel would give him a job working the breakfast shift. So he got in there. They put him right on the McGriddles and sausage egg McMuffin stand. Like, it was a dream come true for him, actually. I mean, he didn't realize it at the time because he did really love the McDonald's breakfast. And he was surprisingly good at it. He was better at making McDonald's breakfast than he was at making pottery in college. And he thought, wow, my parents sure wasted a lot of money on my art degree. But here I am now, and I'm going to make the most of it. So he threw his heart and soul into specifically the sausages. That was what he focused on. He enjoyed the sizzle sound. It sort of felt like a nice counterbalance to the electric fiddle sound that he was used to hearing. And, you know, he liked unique sounds, if you haven't figured that out about Billy. He was a peculiar guy, and he had peculiar tastes. So he loved that sizzle. He loved the smell of mystery meat formed in a patty. And he was just enjoying it. And he was enjoying it so much that the clock hit 11 and he didn't want to stop. And Mr. Gabriel said, well, it's 11. You got to move on to the Big Macs, the fries. He's like, but people still want these hash browns. They're delicious. And I know it's 11:05, but we still have some to serve. Could I at least just serve out this batch of hash browns and these delicious sizzling sausages while we have them? You know, I don't want to waste anything. You know, that feels wasteful. There are people that go to bed hungry all over the world, and I don't think that it would be prudent to waste food. It feels irresponsible. And Mr. Gabriel thought about it, and he said, you know what? You make some good points, and I love that you love the fiddle song in the end of Revenge of the Nerds, so I'm going to let you distribute the rest of these breakfast treats until noon, let's say. And so he did that, and it was wonderful. He felt like he was making changes, even on his first day. You know, he was a new guy, but he had some bold ideas. He had bold ideas, and he knew what the people wanted. And so the second day, this continued.
And Billy realized he wasn't just creating breakfast, he was creating a movement. People were packed inside this McDonald's all day. News cameras were in front. It was trending on the web. Mr. Gabriel was over the moon. He said this McDonald's store will reach an all-time profit margin not seen since Store 601 in San Bernardino, California. But Billy could feel something was amiss. Something was coming down the pipe that was disturbing. He couldn't put his finger on it. And then, at 3 p.m., he put his finger on it. The doors opened and in walked J. Roderick McDaniels, the CEO of McDonald's. When he first got the job, the press had a field day with his last name. McDaniels running McDonald's? It's impossible. But he had all those reporters put in an island prison. He was ruthless. He ruled the fast food industry with an iron fist. He was the most terrifying man, according to Forbes, of 2023. The doors opened and in walked J. Roderick McDaniels. In his booming voice, "Who's in charge of this store?" Billy turned to Mr. Gabriel, who fainted. It sounded like a bag of golf clubs hitting the floor, his giant body crashing against the counter. Billy stood up. "It's me, sir." "Who the hell are you?" "Who the hell are you?" said McDaniels. "I'm Billy, sir. It's my second day here. My true passion is clay. But I gotta tell you something. You're running your stores wrong. It's not about the money. It's not about the power. It's about the people. Look at these people. Look at their faces right now. They're happy. They're eating gristle and fillers, and they're happy. And you want to take that from them? Well, I won't let you. I will not let you take their happiness." McDaniels nodded and looked around. Interesting. Very interesting. But, alas, no. And he pulled the sheath off of his walking cane, revealing it to be an incredibly long Derringer pistol. And he pointed it right at Billy. And he fired. And the bullet flew right towards Billy, striking him in the chest. And McDaniel said, "Throw away your breakfast sandwiches. In fact, breakfast sandwiches are canceled." "Oh, no," said a voice. "It's actually you who's canceled." McDaniels turned around to see Billy standing, not dead. What could have possibly stopped the bullet? Billy reached under his shirt and pulled out the necklace that he's been wearing since he was a boy, of an electric violin with a bow. "You are canceled from McDonald's."
"No,"
said McDaniels. He jumped out of the window and ran into traffic, getting smashed by a bus, flying into the air, getting hit by a taxi cab, and then being run over by a steamroller. Billy looked at everyone and said, "Breakfast on me, everyone." They all clapped and raised Billy onto their shoulders. He was the true champion of McDonald's. And then he turned to them and said, "I must go." They said, "No, you can't leave. Why are you leaving? You have given us life. You've given us hope." And Billy said, "Because it's not my true passion. Now, if you'll excuse me, I gotta throw some stuff in the kiln." And as he walked out of that McDonald's store, he heard the song that he had been trying to play in his car, but it sounded so beautiful and clear. That of Poindexter from Revenge of the Nerds playing the electric fiddle. The end. Latkes, A Hanukkah Tale. Little 80 Bernstein loved Hanukkah. She loved the presents. She loved the Hanukkah guilt. She loved spinning the dreidel. But the thing she liked more than anything about Hanukkah was the latkes. She would eat 10 times more latkes than the rest of her family. Some people like sour cream. Some people like applesauce. Adie liked them both. Adie liked Latke so much, she said that when she grew up, she was going to have a dog and name it Latke. She was obsessed with them all year round. The day after Hanukkah ended, she would think about, when can I have latkes again? So one year, Hanukkah was coming up, and Adie was so excited. She was at school, and she was talking to some of her friends. And her friends were like, "Adie, are you like really excited for like like presents. What are you going to get this year? I am totally going to get a Nintendo Switch. And he was like, yeah, I don't care. You know, whatever. I'll get whatever. Like, what do you mean you don't care about presents? She's like, honestly, as long as I have Lockies, I don't even care. That's just the most important thing to me. And her friends were like, you are crazy. So Ada gets home and she sees her mom and dad sitting at the kitchen table on Hanukkah night. And they look really, really sad. And Adie's like, what's wrong? And they turn to their daughter and said, Adie, we don't know how to tell you this. There has been a problem with all of the potatoes in this state. There's a bit of a blight on them. And the potato crop this year has been terrible. And I don't know really how to say it, so we're just going to say it, said her dad, but we're not going to be able to have latkes this year. Ada didn't remember the next five or six things that he said because she was depersonalizing, trying to process the stress and the grief of imagining a Hanukkah without latkes. When she came to, she told her parents, I just had a crazy dream that you guys told me there were no potatoes in the state of New Jersey. And we couldn't have latkes. And her mom said, we did tell you that. That's what's happening. But it's okay. We're going to have a really, really great Hanukkah. And we don't need to have latkes to have a great Hanukkah. And Adie smiled, but it was a fake smile because she knew the reality that she needed latkes to have a great Hanukkah. So Adie ran out of the house and said, I'm going for a quick jog. And the minute she started jogging, she started sobbing. She's walking through her neighborhood, just, I can't believe Hanukkah is ruined because there's no potato. And all of a sudden, she heard a voice say, why are you crying? She turned and looked, and it was Mr. O'Leary, the old man himself. Mr. O'Leary had been their neighbor for 15 years. And for 15 years, Ada and her friends thought that he was some kind of psycho, the old crazy man in the neighborhood. You never know. They say that he had a lot of knives. They say that he was a crazy guy. And she looked at him as he had this quizzical look on his face. And for some reason, she wasn't scared of him. And she answered him and she said, I can't have latkes this year because there's no potato. And Mr. O'Leary said, oh, there's no potato, is there? Well, maybe all I can help with that. She looked at him as she wiped the tears from her eyes. How can you help me with that? She said. He slowly rose and walked off of his front porch towards her. He was old, like really old. Like he walked with two canes. And as he approached her, he said to her, I have a secret for you. And she said, what is it? And he goes, well, I'll show you. And he opened his gate to his garden. And he said, this is my magical garden. She said, are you Australian? I thought you were Irish. He goes, no, I'm Irish sometimes. I just sound a little Australian. Don't worry about my accent. All right, I'm sorry. It didn't seem consistent. Do you want me to help you or not? I do, said Ada. He turned, there were no lights because it was natural sunlight. And as she walked into the garden, her eyes exploded. He had everything. He had watermelons, even though it was the winter. He had asparagus, even though it wasn't spring. He had every fruit and every vegetable you can possibly imagine. And he goes, but I know what you're looking for. You're looking for this. And he walked over and opened a big, he couldn't even describe what it was, but it had a big kind of wooden plank over it. And he said, now look at that, and what was down there, but the most beautiful batch of russet potatoes she's ever seen. She goes, potatoes? How did you get potatoes? I heard there was a disease that was killing them. And he says, well, there was, but I have learned how to become a magic gardener. And being Irish, well, I know the importance of potatoes. So once I learned my magic, the first thing I grew was potatoes, but then I couldn't stop. Before you knew it, I was growing onions and plums and muskmelon. She said, oh my gosh, well, what can I do? Can I help you, please? I need these potatoes. And he says, the potatoes are yours. The only thing you have to do is you have to learn how to become a magic gardener, because I won't be around forever and I need someone to take my place. So you take the potatoes, but you promise that you will come back and I can teach you the magic so I can pass it along to you, because I didn't have children. Personal choice. Didn't want to do it. My wife wanted to, but I said no. But you come back and I will teach you how to be a magic gardener. She said, see, right there again, it sounded Australian at the end. You said gardener. And he said, look, I'll rescind the offer if you mention the accent again. Ida knew when to quit and said, thank you so much, Mr. O'Leary. And I'm so sorry that all the kids in the neighborhood thought you were like a scary, crazy killer. And he said, what? Who says that? And she was, nothing. I was kidding. And she ran out of the house. She ran home with the potatoes in her hands. And just as her mom was about to make mashed broccoli as the side, Ada kicked the door open and said, not today, Mama. And she turned and said, Ada, where did you get those potatoes? Mr. O'Leary, she said, he's a magic gardener. Oh, Mr. O'Leary's a very nice man. But I still can't make latkes. Ada's eyes widened. Why not? Because I broke my box grater, her mom said, and held up her broken box grater. Ida rolled her eyes, sprinted back over to Mr. O'Leary's, breathless, and banged on the door. Who is it? She said, it's Ada. Who? Ada, I was here like 4 minutes ago. Oh, right. Yeah, hold on. I'm all the way up the stairs. It's going to take me a minute to get back down. Ada stood there, tapping her foot as she could see him on his little chair and that kind of slowly goes down the staircase. He got off, opened the door, and she said, Mr. O'Leary, do you have a box grater? He said, box grater? Yeah, I do. Hold on. Walked to the kitchen, came back with a brand new, never used box grater. He said, please wash it right after you use it, because I don't want the little pieces of potato to be stuck in it, because once they get stuck in there, they're hard to get out. She said, of course, thank you, sir. She ran back home, opened the door, threw the box grater in the air. Her mom caught it in her left hand and started grating those potatoes. And Ada ran over and she grabbed the shredded potatoes and she put them in a dish towel. She wrang out all of the water and then she put those potatoes inside of a bowl and put in some flour and egg and salt and pepper, and she formed them into perfect little patties. As her mom heated up the oil, Ada flung them down to the hot pan, turning them till they're crispy and brown. And then, short 5 minutes later, Ada sat down for Hanukkah dinner with her mom and dad and little brother Mickey, and her mom placed on the table the most beautiful platter of latkes she'd ever seen. And Ada's dad walked in and said, oh, latkes, I thought we were out of potatoes. And Ada said, well, Mr. O'Leary gave them to me because he's a magic gardener. And the dad said, oh, the Australian guy down the street. And Ada slathered sour cream and applesauce on her latke, put it into her mouth, and took the most perfect bite ever. And Ada knew that was going to be the most special Hanukkah ever. The end.
Once upon a time, there was a young man named Barry. And Barry had just graduated from high school. And he had not gotten into any of the colleges he wanted to go to. He got into a few schools. You know, he wasn't the best student. He was a bright kid, but, you know, he had some issues with test taking, and, you know, a lot of these standardized tests are kind of antiquated. And, you know, if you're in the wrong school and you don't have the right teacher, it doesn't necessarily mean you're not a smart kid. It just means you learn differently. And Barry learned differently. But he was really good at making things. He was a very tactile learner. And he may not have been good with his spelling tests or his math tests, but he would often go into his father's garage on the weekends, and he would just tinker with things. He would build things. He would build different pieces of art. And oftentimes, you know, his dad wasn't really super handy and wasn't really into, you know, building a lot of things. So Barry just had to take what was ever laying around the garage, and he would make things out of it. And what he didn't realize at the time was he was becoming a very talented found object sculptor, which is not something his father knew anything about. His father was an accountant. His mother was a lawyer, and they didn't have an artistic bone in their body, but they liked that it was something that Barry was interested in, and they sort of encouraged it. They didn't discourage it. They were just kind of lukewarm on the whole thing. They were just kind of lukewarm people in general, but Barry wasn't. He had a passion for building things. Well, he was really disappointed that he didn't get into the colleges that he wanted to get into, and he knew it was because of his grades. And he was feeling pretty low that summer as he weighed his options, which weren't many. And so he just went into his father's garage and he started building something. He started constructing. Well, he didn't know what he was making actually when he started. He just feverishly started assembling random pieces of pallet wood he found out on the curb and some old metal plates. And he didn't know where he was going with this, but he was enjoying the process. And one day he went out into the neighborhood to collect some objects for whatever piece this was going to be, and he found
a giant sparkling hook. He finally knew where he was headed. So this hook was really large. He had to go back home, go to his father's garage, get a wagon, and come back and haul this back home. And he knew that this thing was going to be way bigger than he could have even imagined. But Barry knew he just had to fortify his base and keep going. And he started to build it taller and taller and taller until his neighbors started to come by and ask, "Barry, what is that?" And he said, "You'll see when it's ready." So Barry had to find ladders upon ladders upon his roof. He was on top of his roof, and his parents were now beginning to get a little concerned. They said, "What is this?" And he said, "Trust me." Until Barry was finally ready to put on his giant sparkling hook. And when he did, he knew he'd made the right choice. Knew that this would be a game changer for his town. And he knew what he had to do.
The next day, he towed that giant crane to City Hall, and he met with the mayor, who was very lovely and patient to take a meeting with a recent high school grad. And Barry said to the mayor, he said, "Mayor, I know you've got a lot of construction projects planned, and check it out. I made a crane, and it's pretty cool. And if you want to like give me some money for it, then I was thinking maybe I could start a crane business because I didn't get into the colleges that I wanted to. And I don't know, this could be the beginning of something truly beautiful." And the mayor sighed and he looked at this crane, and it was not a load-bearing crane. This was a piece of art. This was a giant sculptural installation piece. And he said, "Oh, Barry," he's like, "I appreciate the effort. I really like you. I like your parents. You're a nice family. This is interesting, but I don't know how functional it is. You know, these things need to pass engineering tests. And, you know, there could be lawsuits, you know, if we were to actually use this crane and something were to go wrong. And it could end badly for a lot of folks. And especially for a construction worker below that crane if it were to fall, and we don't want that to happen. But I really do appreciate your effort, Barry. Barry was visibly disappointed. His shoulders sunk, his face dropped, and he got back in his truck and he drove off, and he towed that crane behind him. And as he's driving through town, he started to get a little hungry, and there was a cute little area of shops and bakeries and coffee shops and art studios. And he just found a parking spot. He was very lucky to find a parking spot. I mean, he had a truck and he was towing this gigantic crane behind him, but he found a parking spot right in front of this art studio. And he got out and he took a look at the crane, kind of sighed again, and went into the bakery to get himself a donut. And as he was eating his donut, the owner of the art studio emerged from her studio.
When she saw what Barry had built, she stood stone still, and she could not believe her eyes. It was a beautiful, complex statement about art, about life, about construction, and frankly, a feat of structural engineering. She felt so lucky and so inspired. She began running into each shop, begging to see if anyone knew who this beautiful, beautiful crane belonged to. And finally, as she's running into the bakery, she runs headfirst into Barry. Barry has powdered sugar all over his face. He drops his donut, and he immediately begins apologizing. He cannot believe his luck today. He is having a no good, very bad day. He is so unlucky. And he stands up, looks at this woman, and she profusely apologizes and explains why she's in a rush. She is looking for the genius that created this installation and then just left it in the parking lot. And Barry freezes. His brain cannot even compute what she's saying. He had faced all this rejection and felt so lost and so defeated. And now this woman was reframing everything. And he stuttered out, "Yeah, it's mine. I made it. My name is Barry." And the woman smiled and she said, "Barry, it is very, very nice to meet you. We are going to have a very, very beautiful friendship." She introduced Barry to her friend who runs an art school. And she sent Barry's pictures of Barry's art all around the country, all around the world, because she knew people had to see this. And that was the beginning of Barry's very, very, very good luck. So Barry began school, and then he went to graduate school, and then he was studying all around the world, studying structural, sculptural art. He was working with all different types of textiles. He was inspiring and changing art scenes all around the world. Barry became one of the most memorable, most famous structural, sculptural artists the world has ever seen. And Barry felt really good. The end. Once upon a time, there was a very, very fluffy little dog. And he was alone. He didn't remember where he came from. And he was very small. And he knew where to find snacks behind the old bakery. He knew where to get water over by the beautiful stream. He didn't really have many friends. He would growl at the cat that stood on top of the garbage cans. And he would chase some squirrels. But he was very alone, and this little fluffy, fluffy puppy one day stumbled upon a little girl who was walking out of her dance class, and he fell in love. He knew that this little girl was his person. She was happy, she was bouncing around, she had the coolest purple tutu, and he just wanted to be her dog. And so he came up with a plan. Every day, he saw this big yellow car full of children. And so he figured there were so many kids on there, he had to run into her. So he followed this big yellow car. And it was driving very fast through the town. But he arrived at a huge building full of all the children. And so he snuck inside as someone was closing the door. And he began searching. He snuck in every room, every closet, every single door, until finally he saw the little girl. And he heard her name. Her name was Cassie. And he was satisfied, so he waited. He snuck back outside and he waited to follow the big, giant yellow car home, where he knew he could find Cassie. Only Cassie didn't take the big yellow car out. So he began searching. He ran and found a huge field and saw Cassie now. She was kicking this big white and black ball, and he really wanted to play. So he ran right out onto the field and decided to join her. Except right as he was about to reach Cassie, this big giant man picked him up and said, "Who are you? What are you doing here? You don't allow dogs on the field." So picked him up, called someone, and they took him away. They took him far away from Cassie, and they put him in a crate. And he was so sad. He failed. He couldn't find her. And he cried. He was so heartbroken. He didn't know what to do. But then someone walked in, and she smelled so good. She smelled like cookies and Christmas trees and latkes. Like, she had just been cooking all day. And he really was very hungry. And she asked him his name. And he didn't know how to answer her. He'd never really thought about a name. But he was very happy to see her. An amazing, warm, delicious-smelling lady picked him up and said, "You're just the one." So this lady puts him in her car, and this time it's a very nice car. He is sitting right in front. She gives him a toy. He can't believe his luck. He's feeling very good about this, but still wondering how he can sneak away and get to Cassie. They pull up to this big, beautiful apartment building, and she tries to bring him into an elevator, which he's seen people get in, but he's not feeling good about. But she says, "I promise you it'll be worth it." And he says, "Okay, maybe if I get some food, I can get back out searching for Cassie, but this lady's being very nice." So he agrees and follows her into the elevator. Now, when these elevator doors open, he begins to smell something. It's not only cookies, it's not only latkes, it's not only Christmas tree, but he smells the best smell he's ever smelled. It's Cassie. And this wonderful lady opens the door and says, "I have someone who would really like to meet you." And it's Cassie. He sees Cassie and sprints full force into her arms, and she is giggling and she is crying, and she said, "Yes, you are exactly the one." And the lovely lady, who always smells like cookies, asks, "So what's his name?" And she says, "It's gotta be something sweet and fluffy and smart and loyal. His name is Ted." And Ted kissed Cassie because it was the best name he had ever heard. It was the best name he'd ever imagined. And he and Cassie went to school. He rode the bus. He got kicked off the soccer field again. So Ted learned that he was not supposed to play on the soccer field. But there were so many wonderful things that he and Cassie and the new lady he learned was named Mom could do together. He could sneak cookies off the table. He definitely got some latke scraps. He sat near the fire, roasty, toasty, and warm. He could play all sorts of games with Cassie. Since she did dancing and soccer, she was very fast. So they would run together and play together and nap together. This was exactly the kind of thing he liked to do. And Cassie said, "I can't believe how long it took me to find you." And Ted thought the exact same thing. She just understood him. So he and Cassie would go on big, long walks around the neighborhood with his big, fluffy coat to keep him warm. And Cassie also had a big, fluffy coat, although she didn't grow her own. But Ted loved her so much. They would stop and get ice cream. They would stop and meet her friends. And when no one was looking, she would sneak him onto the soccer field. And then they would run and run and run and run. And one day, Cassie tripped and hurt her knee. And she had scraped it really good. He knew because he had done the same once. But Ted knew just how to help her. He ran up and licked her whole face. And that seemed to make her feel better. So together, they walked home. Mom patched Cassie's knee right up. They sat by the fire. They had some hot cocoa, although his wasn't really cocoa, he could tell. And they began to fall asleep. And Ted thought, wow, this is the best present I could ever imagine. And Cassie felt the same. And they both fell asleep for the night.